Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. My Olympian mission is to promote lifelong personal development, human empowerment, out-of-the-box thinking, creative self-expression, and a dedication of one's unique talents to community service. All of my labors in this lifetime celebrate the hero's journey in myth, legend, spirituality, popular culture, and in daily life. I firmly believe that the human spirit is essentially heroic and always seeking ways to express its innate nobility and greatness, and that a life fully lived, dedicated to actualizing the highest we can conceive, is the noblest expression of human existence. Before we begin tonight's show, I'm going to play a very quick song, If You Can Dream.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real.
We're back. I'm Hercules Invictus, and our show tonight is Living Hellenismos with Tony Mrzwicki, who wrote the book on Hellenismos. Greetings and welcome, Tony. How are you? Hello, Tony.
Hey, Hercules. How are you? I understand that this is the 400th episode on
yes,
the new channel
is.
For Mount Olympus Presents. So congratulations are in order. Woo-hoo!
Thank
we should
you
be
so
cracking
much.
Open above the bubbly.
And we definitely have to do that. We have a caller. Let me see if this is your guest that's arrived. Greetings. Is this Yesha? Hello?
You've got me.
Okay, I know I've got you, and I've got your double. So let me...
My double. My doppelganger.
Ah, okay. Let's see if we can get rid of one of those. Okay, can you hear me, Tony? Okay. Hello, Tony? Hi, can you hear me? Okay.
Yes, yes, I can now.
Somebody did call in, but they're not answering. Is your guest calling from a 562 number?
She lives in Northern California. I'm not sure if that's 562 or not. I thought I had a phone number, but I don't.
Okay.
I have actually met up with her when she's come into the LA area, but and I don't know how I did it. I must have had a number at one stage, but I've got a newish sort of phone, and I may not have a number. So,
okay, let me check maybe again. 562 is a California area code. So, hi,
Northern California.
No, this is Janet.
Oh, Janet. Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you doing? Sorry.
She can always pretend to be Esha.
Okay. Well, I'm sure both of you have lots of new things to share, so I wouldn't mind if we have a conversation for an hour. I'd enjoy that a lot.
Yeah. Well, I actually did a review of Jean-Louis's book.
Awesome. Let's start there.
Yeah, it's actually a fascinating book. It's called The Ultimate Pagan Almanac. And he basically pointed out that there's an echo. I don't know if you can hear it or not.
Is your computer on? Maybe that's...
No, I'm only using the cell phone.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, it seems to be better now. Anyway, so he points out that it's intuitively obvious that there are days that are going to be more effective for rituals than other days, but how you determine those days is open to question. So he points out that almost all ancient calendars were based on the natural cycles of the sun and the moon. So by basing it on the sun, you're working with the four seasons. So the wheel of the year was determined by the equinoxes and solstices, and there are intermediary celebrations. So we're talking about Imbolc, Beltane, Lunasar, and Samhain, which are the halfway points between the equinoxes and solstices. So what most people do is that they have standardized dates for the eight Sabbats on the wheel of the year. And Jean-Louis points out that they would be better off working with the actual days, finding out what the actual dates of the equinoxes are, the solstices are, and then finding the intermediate points. And he says that the difference between working on the correct day and almost the correct day lies in being able to tap into the full amount of accessible energy. The bit which really stood out to me is, if anyone who's worked with ceremonial magic is familiar with the idea of planetary days, and you take it for granted that that Saturday corresponds to Saturn and Kronos, Sunday corresponds to the Sun and Helios, Monday corresponds to the Moon and Selene, Tuesday corresponds to Mars and Aries, Wednesday corresponds to Mercury and Hermes, Thursday to Jupiter and Zeus, and Friday to Venus and Aphrodite. So when you determine the planetary hours, you divide up the length of the daytime hours into equal lengths, and the time of the nighttime hours into equal lengths, and then determine the optimum time for your ritual. So he proposes that the days that we're using are actually incorrect. So what he proposes that we do is you start off with the new moon and consider that to be day one. So day one, the new moon, would be Saturn and Kronos. Day two would be Sun and Helios. Day three would be Moon and Selene. Day four, so these are the days of the lunar calendar. Day four is Mars and Aries. Day five is Mercury and Hermes. Day six is Jupiter and Zeus. Day seven is Venus and Aphrodite. Then that cycle is repeated three more times. And then you're going to have one or two days left over. And those days should be dedicated to the ether. So that way you could actually marry together the planetary days with the Athenian calendar, which I've used as well. And because it's so difficult to reconcile the two, I've thought of them as an either-or proposition. So either I'm working with a lunar calendar or I'm working with the planetary days of the week. Using his system, you can actually marry the two together. It's a fascinating idea. And so he writes on that more extensively in his book titled Rediscover the Magic of the Gods and Goddesses, which I'm going to read through.
I was going to comment that he dealt with that. That was one of the first books I reviewed this time around with for Llewellyn. And I remember he talked about the great Lent in that book.
Yeah, I'd like to get my hands on that book as well. I might contact Llewellyn and see if they'll send me a review copy.
Mm-hmm.
So then in his book, he also incorporates, obviously, the zodiac signs, the 36 ancient Egyptian deacons, the astrological rulers and astral events, such as eclipses. And then he incorporates a number of calendars. So I've already mentioned the Athenian or Attic calendar, but there's also the Druidic or Gaulish calendar, the Roman calendar, Pletho's calendar, which was put together during the Byzantine era, and the Egyptian calendar. So when you flip through the book, you look up any day, and you can see all the gods that can be worked with from the various pantheons. Plus, you've got the astrological influences. It's absolutely fascinating. So it dawned on me that when you have a full idea of all the gods that can be worked on a particular day, if you wind up getting unusual results, it could well be because of the other magical influences entering in. And for those people who work with multiple pantheons, the book would be an absolute godsend. But just the idea of being able to marry together planetary days and the Attic calendar is absolutely fascinating to me. So that was the bit that jumped out at me. So the review that I wrote of the book is admittedly a little bit on the short side, but I think it's certainly a book that merits investigation.
Oh, definitely. I have not experimented with Jean-Louis' system. Basically, what I found in my experimentations are that it doesn't really alter the results if I like play with the system, as long as I'm following the planetary days and their rulers. I tend to work with the Sunday through Saturday system that we have in our society, because that's the reality we're currently living in. So I just follow that because that's the consensus reality. And I know that people rearrange their order depending on what was known at the time about the ordering of the planets. And that takes a while to figure out and get used to. So I've experimented with like the Neo-Theosophical system and found that it works just as well as the common system for me.
Yeah. The thing is that you've got the entire Western world working with the same calendar, so that must set up an egregore of sorts. So my usual thing is, you know, the proof of the pudding's in the eating, so I think it'd be worthwhile trying out the system and seeing what sort of results you get. And I mean, in your case, you felt that the results were good but no better than what you were getting ordinarily,
right? So it was less confusing to just go with the calendar that we have. Even though it's inaccurate, like the zodiac signs are no longer really aligned to the days assigned them.
No.
But that's what the consensus reality is for our culture. So as long as I'm living in our culture, I tend to use that rather than the more correct points in which we're moving through the zodiac signs.
Yeah. Yeah, but all in all, it's an absolutely fascinating concept.
Yeah,
And I think it's great that he's proposed it, he's put it out there, and there will be people who will be dabbling in it and trying it out, and I'm really looking forward to getting feedback from people who do try it out to see how effectively it works for them.
When I get around to that, I will definitely give you my feedback.
Don't just give it to me. Give it to the world. Because I think that there are a lot of...
I was scared with you as well.
Yeah. But I think that there are going to be a lot of people out there who are going to be interested.
And Jean-Louis is an excellent scholar. He's a penultimate scholar. So reading his writing is like reading fact-filled poetry. I don't know how else to describe it. He's very good at all his stuff is very well thought out, very well organized, and very has a lot of thought in it. You can feel that.
Yeah, and the other pleasant surprise in the book was a very short essay by Apollonius, who was writing under John Obstipaus.
Uh-huh.
And it's about Lethon, who he's been focusing on. It's basically a four-page essay, and so it's a good introduction to the work that he's been doing with Lethon. So that was a pleasant surprise that I wasn't expecting in the book. It is quite an amazing text. There are excerpts in it from Apuleius and the Golden Ass, the Mysteries of Isis. There's even an interview with Karl Weschke. So much good stuff in the book, apart from the calendar. But I remember when I first started my path, I would always make a point of buying an ephemeris. So mm-hmm. I knew what planetary influences were, when the solstices and equinoxes took place, if there were any eclipses. So I knew everything that was taking place. So those things obviously cause changes in the energy that you can tap into, and you can exploit those by getting rather interesting ritual results. So he's basically taken that and taken it an extra couple of steps by introducing references to various other calendars. So it's an absolutely fact. There's so much work that's gone into this book.
Yeah.
And I hope it takes off and that he puts out similar books every year. I can see a lot of people drawing a lot of value from it.
Yes, he has, because of his position as a Grand Master of the Aurum Solis, which he generously shares, I'm sure, as much as he could, and the network that he's built up of people like yourself, so much information is there. It's like sitting down at a great feast where you can't possibly taste everything that's set before you, but there's so many things that look so yummy and that you want to try.
That's one of the best things about the society that we're living in. Hundreds of years ago, you had to join secret societies to mm-hmm. gain access to materials, and these days, almost everything's out there, and the things that aren't out there yet are just waiting to be translated, and it's just a matter of a few more years.
Very, very true. Do you remember the days of seeking through esoteric bookstores and thrift shops to try to find obscure texts, and then if you went to the esoteric bookstore, it would take a year or two to get the book and a whole mess of money. Now, for instance, I spent years looking for the Arbitel, and I never found a copy. Now, with the print on demand and with the internet, I have many different translations of the Arbitel, and most of them were available for free online.
Exactly. It was a really confused world that we were living in. We had one bookstore back home, which was owned by the Theosophical Society. So they would have books on wisdom, theosophical texts and mainstream mm-hmm. spiritual texts, but there was absolutely nothing there on ceremonial magic. So there was no Crowley, no Kenneth Grant, no Golden Dawn stuff, nothing. Nothing connected to practical magic. Then there were other bookstores which were a little bit more laid back. I also heard murmurs back in the day that they had books that were hidden under the counter.
Yeah.
It's almost like a drug deal where the owner would get to know you. Once they decided that you were serious, a serious seeker, and that you'd be using the knowledge that you got responsibly, then they would give you access to those books.
Yes, I remember. Go ahead.
So it was the same thing here, was it?
Yeah, it was the same thing here. I used to go to the Warlock shop, and then later on the Magical Child that Herman Slater had. And, it basically became a point where when they used to normally close the shop, they'd let me in there. And I would see that the bookcases against the wall were not – there were doors, and they had a whole back area back there. So they finally invited me in the back area, and I had access to all these books that they didn't put on the shelves. So that was great.
Fantastic. I don't know of anything quite that exciting back in Sydney, but, all that we had were a few books that were available under the counter, and the other books that were kept under the counter were Franz Baden books. Anything that was thought of as real and powerful was kept under the counter, whereas the fluffy stuff was kept on the shelves.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it was in the Magical Child, and in some places still. You know, I remember when we had our store, the Barbarian Bazaar, and then later on the Mount Olympus Marketplace. We used to keep the rarer things behind the counter and wouldn't put them out, you know, with the more readily available books. And we wanted to make sure those found homes with somebody who could really use them and appreciate them and understand them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's just I don't know why Yesh didn't turn up today. I was really looking forward to interviewing her, and I had the questions prepared like almost a month ago, and she actually contacted me yesterday just before 6 o'clock. She thought it was going to be on yesterday, and I said no, it's Sunday. She says, oh, that's even better. So I didn't even think of checking with her during the day. I contacted her maybe 15 minutes before the show, and it's sad that she's not here. She's quite an amazing lady, and a lot of people think of her as connected to her daily devotions where she works with Kuan Yin, but she works with a number of other goddesses, including a number of Greek goddesses. So the main ones for her were Aphrodite, Hecate, and Gaia. So the interview is basically going to be on her workings with those three goddesses. And actually this month she's been burning a candle to Aphrodite. So I thought it would have been excellent for the show. And yeah, and I thought that the listeners would have really enjoyed it. Would have really enjoyed it. Her heart's very much in the right place. She also has an anthology coming out at the moment. She's soliciting for contributions to that anthology. Again, it's on Kuan Yin. It's going to be called Lotus Heart, The Compassion of Kuan Yin. It's basically a book of women's experiences.
That sounds interesting.
So it's, I think it's going to be quite an interesting text when it comes out, and I was looking forward to having her here to actually talk about it. But, you know, life is sometimes full of disappointments. That's the way it goes.
It happens, and especially with live podcasts. It happens every now and then. I usually have like a plan B and a plan C just in case nobody calls, and that has happened. Not very often, but it has happened. You know, emergencies pop up, people forget, they get caught up in something else, and they lose track of time. But still, I found that these things that don't go as planned often provide opportunities that you would not have had if things had gone according to plan. Maybe we could discuss something that's been on my mind of late.
Sure. Yeah, we'll wing it from now on.
I put Janet on mute, but if Janet's interested in popping in, I'll put her on unmute, and she's welcome to join us if she'd like. If not, that's fine too.
She just popped her head in and goes, no.
Okay,
I'm actually at her place at the moment.
you're back on mute, Janet. One thing I want to do after the pandemic is I want to put together some form of organization, which would be, again, like hosted by Mount Olympus and Olympian spirituality, but not exclusive to Mount Olympus and Olympian spirituality. And before the pandemic, I actually started to put something like this together. And in fact, when I was thinking about it, I brought it up in our theurgy forum a couple of times. Now I'm ready to move on it. And I was wondering if you would have some thoughts to share, and I could bounce some thoughts off of you. I belong to a couple of pagan councils, and I'm considered an elder.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted this to be something different. I wanted it to focus on the humanity we all share and to pick a cause that we could all agree upon. And then regardless of what else we're doing and regardless what paths to the divine we happen to follow, together we pick something that needs to be that needs some attention and focus on that. And then we would have meetings where we talk about our collective adventures and our collective actions and let other people know what's going on, and then let other people know how they can join in if they'd like, either as part of what we're doing or on their own.
I actually really like that idea, and I'll tell you why. I think it's wonderful to pick a cause that a lot of people believe in, but the thing is that I've been part of groups where someone comes up with a ritual which is supposed to be a one-size-fits-all ritual, and some people are going to feel comfortable working that ritual and other people won't.
Right.
So I like the idea of fixing a goal and have everyone converging on that goal from a place where they feel comfortable, where they feel fully empowered. So say in my case, if I'm working with Greek gods or with Egyptian gods, I will come from there. But there are going to be people, say, working with the Norse gods or the Roman gods. So they can work from those particular pantheons, but we're all aiming at the same sort of thing. And I noticed that we had very similar sorts of things happening leading up to the last election. You had a lot of people focusing on a fair election, and they basically wanted things to improve in this country. And so you had a number of disparate groups. Some groups had come together, and if they're groups that normally do workings together, then it's very appropriate for them to come up with a joint ritual. I had access to a couple of joint rituals like that, some of which I liked, some of which, well, I wasn't that thrilled on. But the thing is that having people coming from their own traditions works really well. And I've worked with people working with coming from a Christian tradition, calling on Catholic saints and the like, calling on angelic energies. And so long as we're all focused on the same end, those rituals will work. And I think that they will work very powerfully. For me, the most important thing is that the heart connection with the gods, but there's also the heart connection with the goal that we're aiming at. And if we had Brandy here, she would be saying our number one goal would be to target homelessness. That's been her primary focus over the last few years. And I think that is a really important goal, but there are a number of other goals as well. But to focus on a goal a month or a goal every 2-3 months and then change over to something else, I think that is an idea that holds a lot of promise.
I think it has a lot of promise too, and it would echo something I did a couple of times with the Age of Heroes initiatives. Every now and then when I move, actually, I'll do an Age of Heroes thing in different places. So I did one in New York City. I did one in northeastern Pennsylvania. I started doing a bunch of things here in Jersey, but I haven't settled on the quest yet. I'll read what I have under the Age of Heroes. Age of Heroes, within us all is a unique greatness. All of us were granted divine gifts of birth, and a grand destiny lies ahead for anyone who needs to follow their own inner calling. The age of the victim is finally over, and the Age of Heroes is dawned. The way of the hero posits that one must utilize one's individual strengths to make one's world a better place. One need not be perfect or operating from ideal circumstances either. Are not the heroes that inspire us often tragically flawed? Are their lives not in a state of flux and full of uncertainty? Does this prevent them from attempting and accomplishing great things? Our Age of Heroes initiatives have harnessed the creative energy and focused the attention of many heroic individuals with radically diverse backgrounds over the years, directing towards improving the collective quality of human life. The Age of Heroes welcomes secular, intrafaith, and interfaith participation. As with the Argonaut expedition of old, the champions of different and sometimes warring gods are invited to partner with the champions of Olympus to face great challenges and accomplish things that would benefit the world we all share. So that's what it's all about. And the first Age of Heroes, which was in New York, was about the digital divide. And without any money, we had all sorts of individuals and organizations. And some of these organizations were established nonprofit organizations and even government agencies worked together to create a computer drop-in center in Brooklyn. And again, we had no money initially. This was all a contribution. Then later on, we started writing grants and it became an established thing. And then Bill Gates solved the problem by donating all those libraries, all those computers to libraries. So that became less of a problem. Then in Pennsylvania, it was literacy, not only children's literacy, but adult literacy. Because in the corner of Pennsylvania where I lived in the Catskills, when I first went down there, because they didn't know what to do with me, you know, because what do you do with somebody like me? So I asked them, what's the biggest problem? So they said literacy, especially among adults and kids. And I said, okay, what's the problem with the kids? And they said that the kids don't like the politically correct stuff, so they don't read. And I asked what the problem was with adults, and a lot of adults were proud, and they didn't want to admit that they were illiterate. And so my work during the 7 to 10 years we were down in Pennsylvania was on those areas. And now here in New Jersey, there's so many things to work on. I can't possibly focus on the one. So we're still getting there. But it's always been very effective, and it always provided a way for people who belong to non-traditional spiritualities to dedicate what they're doing to their god or gods or goddess or divine power. So in addition to having people who are Christians of all denominations and people who are Judaic in their spirituality or Muslim, we also had Satanists who dedicated their good works to Satan. We had werewolves who were totemist shamans. We had vampires. We had a bunch of UFO spiritualities and even UFO contactees and abductees. And a lot of other individuals besides. And I mentioned those because they were the extreme of all the people who got involved. And everybody did their best to make the drop-in center a reality. And for a space, before the problem was solved on a bigger level, people in Brooklyn could drop by there for free and have computer time and do whatever they needed to do on the computer. And they would get free computer lessons as well.
That's fantastic. Illiteracy is it's a tricky sort of subject. I remember in the late 2000s, I would see articles about illiteracy back home in Australia, and it was quite a problem. And you know what almost totally addressed illiteracy? This is something a lot of people seem to have forgotten. The J.K. Rowling books. J.K. Rowling appealed to 11-year-olds around the world.
Yeah.
And she made it trendy for kids to read. And when a J.K. Rowling book would come out, kids would line up outside bookstores, for many, many hours. And then as soon as the books would go on sale, they'd buy the book, race home, read it, talk about it with their friends at school, and then they'd read it again. She made reading trendy. And what I noticed was after the whole J.K. Rowling thing took off, I stopped seeing articles about illiteracy, and I thought illiteracy had been pretty well handled in Australia. So I'm surprised and a little shocked that it's still an issue here in some parts. I know that in Pennsylvania you've got a lot of Amish people. Do they have a resistance to things like Harry Potter books. I know that there was a lot of Christian resistance against Harry Potter books at one stage, and they were sort of trying to stop kids from reading them because they thought it was sorcery and evil and that had a nasty influence on kids. But the point was they were fun books, and they instilled values in children, the values of loyalty to your friends and of the necessity of finding a particular goal and fighting for that goal, fighting for what's right for the betterment of your fellows. So it actually instilled a lot of positive values in kids. I see the Harry Potter books as being very, very positive. It just saddens me that there are still pockets of illiteracy left in this country. You have to make reading fun for people. And if they don't want to read Harry Potter books, you know, read something else.
I use the Dungeons and Dragons, not exactly that brand, but I use the fantasy role-playing games, interactive stories, and then the kids got to reading the Percy Jackson books from there, which...
the Percy Jackson books were great.
Yeah, so they started reading those books, but with the kids, that kind of took care of it. And with the adults, we addressed it differently. I was fortunate to be working with colleges and government agencies at the time. So we tried like all sorts of different approaches. We made the computers like very futuristic and gave things a science fiction theme to make it interesting to get involved. And people came. And that was something that I was told had not been done successfully before, to get people to come to these things. But because they were so different, people came. People like creativity. They like being entertained, you know. So with another medium.
The key word is entertained. People want to have fun. And if you can give them an opportunity to learn in a fun environment, then they will come. Yeah, I've come across a number of kids who got to the Greek gods through the Percy Jackson novels.
Mm-hmm.
They got into the Percy Jackson novels and then wanted to investigate the reality behind the fiction. You know, it doesn't matter how you get to the Greek gods so long as you get to them. And if your journey starts with Percy Jackson novels, great. If it starts off with one of those cheesy B-grade movies like Jason and the Argonauts, that works as well.
I found that when in New York, where older men were concerned, when I told this idea to, they immediately brought back memories of these movies and how they always wanted to be a part of these movies. So we used the symbol of the Argo, you know, in the Argonaut voyage, because everybody knew what that was. And it's true.
Oh, that is so cool.
Yeah, so people were Argonauts, and I still call people who participate in these adventures Argonauts, and we started an Order of the Golden Fleece until we were told that to be an actual order, you needed to go through all sorts of occult paperwork, and I don't have time for that right now, so we're going to rename it to something else of the Golden Fleece.
But you made it fun. You gave them something that they could relate to and something that tapped into their childhood.
Right. And they remembered why they got into the human services and related fields in the first place. Because what happens, and I was in the human services for a very long time, for nearly four decades, is you become aware after a time that with all your good intentions of trying to help people, you eventually realize that you're the silken glove that hides the iron fist of the state, which can be, you know, very insensitive. So that's not a good position to be in. And what a lot of people said was that the Argonaut adventure that they had with the digital divide, it gave them back some of that idealism that they started out with, and they were very grateful for it.
Yeah. And those novels or those myths are absolutely timeless. They'll endure forever.
Yes, they will. And we'll approach them in different ways as we have since the dawn of time when they were first recorded. But they live on. And I've been making a study of their different permutations, you know, throughout the ages, and some really obscure but great books that people have written on that topic as well.
Yeah, I'd like to get to at least check out the project, maybe get involved in a small way, and see how it works out. I think, because after all, the spiritual path is supposed to be a life of service, where you serve your fellow man. And if you're not serving others, you're really not living the best life you could be. But by all means, work on yourself, advance spiritually, but you have to be serving others. So, you know, the more I can give back, the better. And encouraging people to do the same would have to be a good thing.
Have you ever done any ancestor work?
I am familiar with my ancestry, like going back a few generations. I'm more familiar with it on my mother's side than my father's side. I must admit I've probably focused more on past life stuff than actual ancestral workings. It's because when you look at my heritage, there is no living tradition. You know, it was wiped out by the Catholic Church. So I've had to tap into something else, which is why I resonate with the Greek tradition and to a slightly lesser extent the Egyptian tradition. So I'm pretty sure that there's a past life connection there, even though I don't think that I have any Greek or Egyptian blood in me.
Llewellyn published three books on ancestors, kind of like in a row, and I had Shelley's been on the show, you know, a few times. She's an awesome lady. So I did every single exercise in her book, some of them several times. And
fantastic.
It was very powerful. And it uncovered stuff that I forgot, you know, totally, or that I thought I had grown past. So it unleashed a lot of really, really difficult things to deal with. But again, that's how you clean the Augean stables, you know, move forward with life. So I'm trying the other two books as well. But I had kind of done some on my own, and some of the exercises she had I figured out on my own. But I never experienced anything as profound as when I did all the exercises in the book. And there were basic stuff, you know, they were very simply structured, and she used the techniques in some of her other books, very, very profound. I don't regret doing it.
No, it certainly sounds like you got a lot out of it. But I think it's one of the Polynesian tribes. It might be the Maoris, who say that a man with no past has no future. It's very important to know your own roots. Otherwise, you really don't know who you are.
And it's very deceptive, too, the investigating your roots, because a lot of cultures are linguistic groups when you go back in antiquity. And so there isn't really like a genetic component. There's more a mimetic component to it. And I'll use Lemnos for an example. When Lemnos was liberated from the Ottomans, the Lemnians still identified themselves as Romans because that's Byzantium. You know, the Romans were in charge before the Ottomans came and took it over. So they didn't see themselves at that point in time as Greeks. And Lemnos, too, existed as part of a Pelasgian empire that precedes Greece. So they had their own alphabet and writing and customs, and they're very closely related to the people in Tuscany, the Etrurians or Etruscans, and the Trojans.
Didn't the Romans see themselves as having descended from the Trojans?
Yes, they did.
Yeah. The other example that I can cite are the Vikings. When people think of Vikings and they're held aloft by white supremacists as all being blonde-haired and blue-eyed, they weren't. They were a motley crew. They were people of different races, different colors, and they were united by traveling around in ships and raping and pillaging. But they certainly weren't all blonde-haired and blue-eyed. I mean, that's very much a myth. But they would have been united by common language, common ideals, but not common race. Definitely not.
a common culture. And there, Norse mythology is full of people from different races intermingling. You know, you have the Aesir and the Vanir, who are two different people. You had the giants. You had the dwarves. You had the Leos and the Dakathar, you know, the elves. And these are beings that came from different worlds on the world tree, and they had children with each other. So the entire mythology does not support the white supremacist viewpoint of the world.
No, it doesn't. It's a very inclusive philosophy, whereas the white supremacists are trying to make it just the opposite. Very exclusive, which is extremely sad. I mean, my attitude is that the gods call us. We don't choose our gods. The gods call us. And if someone feels called by some of the Norse gods, it really doesn't matter what color they are, what race they are. If the gods have chosen them, no one deserves to stand in the way of that choice.
I agree, and I followed the gods of other cultures for a space. I was playing hide-and-seek with my operant archetype, and beyond the cultural mass, I saw the same powers, and then I didn't need to do that anymore because that was the result that kept coming up, and I felt most comfortable on Olympus. But I walked through the Nordic, through the Celtic, through several other pantheons as well. And again, all of them are valid paths. They're like spokes to a wheel, all leading to a central hub.
Oh, I just got a message from Yesha. Sorry to interrupt. She goes, I'm so sorry. We had snow today and everything cut off. I just got it back.
Okay. Somebody just called me. Maybe it's Yesha, and you could talk to her for the rest
Yesha.
Of the show.
Okay. It's going to happen
Yesha,
really quick.
I know, so sorry. We have had terrible weather here in the mountains today, unexpectedly.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to have to rush through something really quickly. I'm going to introduce you very quickly, okay?
Okay, sounds great.
Okay, our guest today is Yesha Matthews, who is a goddess devotee, Dharma practitioner, and licensed minister, ordained and initiated in several different mystery traditions. She serves as the Mandala priestess of the Mount Shasta Goddess Temple, and with her husband, she owns the sacred well shop in Dunsmuir, California. Her temple and shop serve Mount Shasta spiritual pilgrims and worldwide goddess devotees with online and in-person divinations, classes, ceremonies, and retreats. Yesha has dedicated her life to female mysteries, sacred healing practices, and the ways of the goddess with ongoing study and practice in Tibetan Buddhism, Siberian Mongolian shamanism, Aether, mind cosmology, and Dianic goddess spirituality. With a master's degree in women's history from Sarah Lawrence College in New York, she has studied women's mysticism, shamanism, and matriarchal communities for over 20 years. She was ordained a Dianic High Priestess by Zee Budapest in 2007 and brings more than a decade as a diviner, ceremonialist, and soul guide to the Mount Shasta Goddess Temple. Yesha is the co-editor of the forthcoming anthology Lotus Heart, The Compassion of Kuan Yin, which will be available from Girl God Books in spring 2022. So, for those of us who follow Yesha's work, we'll know that she uploads daily devotions, many of which are focused on Kuan Yin, the Buddhist bodhisattva associated with compassion. She works with a number of other goddesses as well, and this month she's been burning a candle to Aphrodite. So, Yesha, I understand that there are three Greek goddesses with whom you work extensively, Aphrodite, Hecate, and Gaia. We might start with Aphrodite, as you've been working with her this month. How did you come to be chosen by Aphrodite, and are there any experiences you'd like to share?
I will tell you, you know, Aphrodite came very powerfully when I was in maybe sixth grade. I remember I was assigned to play her in a school play, and this was before I knew anything about paganism or polytheism, but her mythos, and of course at the sixth grade level, it had to be kind of watered down a little bit, but her mythos really grasped my attention, And she was kind of always there. But the most important thing that I want to share is that there was a time in my life when I was, you know, thinking about my relationships and my future, and I had gone through a really painful breakup, and I wanted to bring new life and new love into my life. And Aphrodite, I decided to commit myself to her for a year. I said, Aphrodite, I'm going to commit myself to you for this year, and I asked you to show me the path to love. And within you know, that ceremony where I gave her my commitment, I received this intuitive knowing message that I was supposed to never, ever again smoke a cigarette. And I had given up smoking pretty much at that point. I used to smoke in my 20s, but I had pretty much given up smoking by my mid-30s. But I still would have an occasional cigarette or drag off of someone's cigarette. And so I said, okay, I commit. I will not smoke again. Interestingly, when Albert, my husband, and I got together 3 months later after I made that pledge, one of the things that he asked me in the beginning of our relationship was if I smoked. And I said, no, I don't smoke. And he said, good, because when I was small, I accidentally put a lit cigarette, the lit end of a cigarette, in my mouth because I didn't know what it was. And I got so sick that now, even if I smell a cigarette, it makes my heart race and I get really sick. So I can't be around it at all. And it was
wow.
Like a light bulb came on. It was almost like, wow, you know, this amazing sign to me that A, Albert was my person, and B, that I had made the right commitment. And, you know, there's in different prayers to Aphrodite, it talks about her different roles, and sometimes she's the patron of, you know, the Sapphos of the world who are longing for love and going through the trials and tribulations and ups and downs of love. But she's also a patron of married women, and married women would give her annual festivals and offerings and ask for their marriages to stay happy and content. And so that's one of the ways in which I work with Aphrodite, and in the Mount Shasta Goddess Temple, we work with her every April.
That is so cool. I'm so glad you gave away smoking. I can't imagine you not with Albert. And for those who haven't met Albert, he's the gentlest, most beautiful man you're ever likely to meet. I can't imagine you with anyone else. Just a personal note. Shout out
yeah,
to Albert if he's listening.
I definitely feel like Aphrodite set me up for complete joyful success.
Absolutely. Okay, so how did you come to be chosen by Hecate? And are there any experiences you'd like to share?
Yeah, you know, Hecate and I have had also a long relationship, not as old as my relationship with Aphrodite, but my relationship with Hecate began probably in my late 20s, early 30s. I wasn't really ready for her until I had come into, you know, a certain maturity. And she has shown herself to me to be a teacher and a way shower. And in really the classical sense of not making the decisions clear to me, but really sort of always being at those crossroads where I have to make a decision. And one of the things that I've experienced working with Hecate has been that there's not really a sense of right and wrong. There's just the choice you make and what you're willing to do and how you're willing to live with that choice once you've made it. So I think that for my work with her, you know, some people really work with her in, you know, what Sarita Deste calls the dark fluff aspect, which I think is hilarious when she says that. They'll work with her as like, ooh, she's a goddess of like mystery and shadow. But that's not really been my experience with her. My experience with her has been really as the torchbearer, Phosphoros, the way shower, and the one who illuminates the path and says, you know, it's your choice. What choice will you make, and can you live with those choices? And I've had multiple different instances in my life of living. I don't know why, but I kind of associate in America that train with her. Crossroads and railroad tracks have a similar energy. They're places of comings and goings. And so I will, you know, work with Hecate by leaving offerings at a crossroads, but I also feel like there's something in the fact that I've always lived near a train track, and the energy of the train is like always, you know, it's always moving and it's never stagnant. And that's kind of how I perceive Hecate.
That's fascinating. I've always lived near train tracks as well, but that's for practical reasons. In Sydney, you can travel just about everywhere by train. But the other thing I was going to mention is that there's an association between her and Charity, because she was celebrated on the dark moon on the 30th of the month, and people would leave offerings of food at the crossroads, and those offerings would be picked up by the poor and by animals. So there is this benevolent, loving side to her as well that so many people miss out on if they just focus on the so-called dark aspects.
I found that to be true as well. And unfortunately, we only have 4 minutes left, and I'd like for both of you to be able to share your contact information.
Hold on. Yes, you could we? Could you come on again next month? Because we've got so much more to talk about.
Oh, absolutely. I feel so terrible. We had a freak snowstorm today, and I had no phone signal at all in my house unexpectedly. But I've been having this problem this weekend, and it's new. But I'd love to come back next month, and I'd love to have a longer conversation with you.
Yes. So more detail on Aphrodite, a little bit more on Hecate, and lots more on Gaia. And we're going to be talking about Themis, the Moirai, the Muses, the Pleiades, and the Graces.
Wow.
So
yes,
should be a great show. Yes, that's definitely. We're on.
Great.
Good. Well, in the meantime, it's easy enough to find me at mountshastagoddesstemple.com or just Google Mount Shasta Goddess Temple. There's only the one. You'll get to me. And I will look forward to coming back next month.
We will love to have you. And it was so wonderful that we got a few minutes with you. This is actually the 400th episode on this particular channel. So it's a milestone episode. So I'm so glad we had a few minutes of you to help us celebrate.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. What a fantastic accomplishment.
Yeah, Hercules is doing a fantastic job with his podcasts.
Well, thank you. And how can people get in contact with you, Tony?
Easiest way is through Facebook, either my personal page or my author page. And if people want to see what blogs I'm writing, I do a Pathos blog called Holistic Spirituality. And I'm so looking forward to having a full hour with Yesh in a month's time. It's like, well, at least we've got a few minutes of it today so people can get to experience the Yesha that I know, a woman who's very, very dedicated to the to not just the Greek goddesses, but a number of other goddesses as well. So, yeah.
Oh,
well,
thank you.
I'm looking forward to it. A month will pass by before you know it, and you whet my appetite for more information. So I'm looking forward to it, Yesha.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for being so gracious about it, too.
And thanks to everybody
for
tuning in. I'm sorry?
Yeah. Of course. I mean, it's a freak snowstorm. No one's got any control over that.
Very true. And thanks to Janet, who's there in the background. And thanks to everybody
who's laughing.
Listened in, whether it was live as we were speaking or on demand later on. Until next time, this is all of us wishing all of you joyous journeys and amazing adventures, and for the minute or so we have left, close with a golden bell.
The wise. up her cries. Lady
okay.
of moonlight, lady of day, I am